Federal leaders like you know that modernizing IT requires updated technology and a culture shift. Stop reacting to change and start leading transformation. Visit BoozAllen.com/Federal News Radio.
The recent Quadrennial Workforce Priorities Report from the Office of Personnel Management. It detailed both challenges and strategies for building the right federal workforce. As a department made of many disparate components and missions, Homeland Security has a tough and never-ending personnel challenge. The DHS Chief Human Capital Officer, Angela Bailey, joined me in studio to discuss DHS and its personnel. Our first topic was how DHS is dealing with the president's management agenda and recent executive orders on personnel and labor relations.
As we're implementing these different agenda items, or we're taking a look at the 21st workforce, for just as an example, because that's one part of the goals with the president's agenda. We look at that, though, and we think to ourselves, how exactly do we ensure that we operationalize this in a way that makes sense for the field, right? That makes sense for the men and women that are actually out there trying to do the job each day. And so as I think about some of these things, let's just take, for example, one of the priorities or one of the goals that we said we were going to work on is enhancing productivity through a focus on employee health. If you were to look at the report that OPM has put out, some of the things that they cover for employee health are things like maybe farmers markets or bike share and things like that. And all of that is excellent for Washington, D.C., right? But it's not going to help us when we have agents and officers and things that are actually out on a line. It's, you know, those are not the kinds of things that they're actually looking for. So one of the things that we're doing within DHS, as an example, to like really make that priority be a reality, and we're looking at family and employee readiness. And so how do we create an environment in which not just the employee, but the employee's family unit is also taken care of as well? That's how we are choosing to operationalize some of these things rather than just having these one-off special things that might work in D.C. We're actually thinking about this a whole lot more holistically.
Sure. If you have an officer on the border, we'll use that example again, they are in actual physical danger in their job. So health has a whole different meaning.
Right.
Or a TSA officer that might be reaching into a bag and Lord knows what is in some of the bags they search. Mm-hmm. I've had some of them tell me, and it's appalling what they might be facing unexpectedly in a given moment. Very different, again, from that analyst in a cubicle on Nebraska Avenue somewhere.
Right, exactly. And so, but we do have to think about the analyst, right?
That well, you've are in still got them, yeah.
Absolutely. We need to think about those because, you know, we do have probably 10% of our workforce that's doing that as well. But to your point with the folks that are down on the border, I went down on the border. And if you ever have the experience to go down on the border and see what our officers and agents across the board have to do, I think it would be very surprising to the American public some of the dangers that they face every single day whenever they're trying to play out their jobs. And so one of the things that I did actually do was meet with some of the, in this case, it was wives whose husbands had been killed in the line of duty. And, you know, when you're sitting across from them and they have their little 5-year-old there and they're not sure how they're going to get them to Little League practice anymore, right? Or that 5-year-old's case, T-ball. But the point is that how do we then make sure they're ready to handle things in the event that that would happen? But not even just a death in the line of duty. How do we ensure, like for a Secret Service agent who's on a detail for months on end, and how do we make sure that his or her family is prepared for that and is able to take care of themselves so that the employee themselves can actually do their job? We need to make sure that we actually take care of their family as well.
We're speaking with Angela Bailey. She's Chief Human Capital Officer at the Homeland Security Department. And switching gears for a moment, let's talk about the cybersecurity workforce. There's a tremendous competition among federal agencies and between the government and the private sectors for cyber people. What are some of the initiatives you're trying to get people in on the cyber front?
Well, a cyber front, yeah, you're right. There is a lot of competition. I think the one thing that kind of sets us apart is we have just an incredible mission. I mean, our mission is top notch, and we are actually able to attract folks into that mission. And so one of the things that we're really starting to think about, and cyber, I think it was the tipping point for us to really take this fresh approach, is when you think about cyber, you have to think about the 21st century, right? Not just today, but where are we headed into the future? And you can't just look back at a current personnel system that we have and say to yourself, how are we going to improve the current personnel system? Because that system was built in the 1920s. It was updated in the 1940s. And it's just senseless to spend any time on that. So really, one of the big, a couple of big initiatives that we've had to do with that is one of the first things we did is make sure that we coded all of our positions, right? Where the heck are these people? Who is actually cyber? Then we're linking all those cyber positions so that we can track those and everything with a really robust position management project that we have going on. We created a joint Human Capital Leadership Council that's joint with the Chief Information Officers, and that's going to be that's our Cybersecurity Workforce Advisory Council. So together, we have HR and CIO working on the latest issues around cybersecurity, recruiting, pay, compensation, et cetera. We and so part of that, one of the things that we've done is, well, we are completely modernizing how we're going to do cybersecurity recruiting, hiring, pay, compensation, benefits, and performance management, and actually training as well. So we are revamping the entire thing.
And how do you get at compensation when there are still narrow strictures for what you can pay and what you can do in the federal government?
Right. Well, we were fortunate that Congress gave us what's called Title VI, okay? But Congress gave us the authority to basically start from scratch and build our own personnel system. And so we are incredibly fortunate in that regards. So one of the ideas that we're going after is market-sensitive pay structures and compensation so that we can get after that cybersecurity labor market. And we're doing a ton of research with both academia, private sector, public sector, working with some of the defense agencies as well, just to make sure that we really have a good understanding of what is market-sensitive pay and then how do you apply that. So that's one of the ways that we're going after that.
It seems like you might have a couple of different situations when it comes to market-sensitive pay. Law enforcement nationally has pay norms and pay scales. Probably it's better in New York City than it might be in, you know, Boise, Idaho for a policeman. But whereas in the cyber front, you're competing with giant industries. You really need flexibility even within the new system you're building.
Right. But for right now, the system that we're building is cyber focused. Yeah. I mean, if my dreams all come true, you know, we'll be incredibly successful, which we will be. But then maybe we can roll that out across DHS and then maybe the federal government. But for today, okay, I just want to focus in on cyber.
Got it, sure.
And so, but we've looked at some of the studies and RAND, for example, has done quite a few studies and stuff even with the military. And when you look at some of these studies, what you'll find is that at the entry level, we are not competitive. So, for example, a kid coming out of high school who just won a national hackathon, golly, gee whiz, we get to offer them a GS2. They're not going to come to work for us today under that particular scenario. Then you look at the cyber security professionals that are at the top end, like you said, the CIOs, the CISOs, and things like that. It's hard to compete with them with their salaries as well. I mean, we no sooner get them in, and they have these phenomenal resumes as a result of the mission that we have. And then they're quickly plucked off, right, and taken into private sector.
Although conversely, they could come in from long or successful careers in the public sector because of the mission. And sometimes they already have the money.
Yes.
And so they're willing to work at the federal salary because they don't need the money, but they really believe in the mission.
Right. No, that's a great point. And so one of the things that we're doing is stop looking at this like as if these folks are going to stay with us for 30 years. Instead, let's think about, again, looking at the 21st century, what does the world of work look like, which is more project-based in this field in particular? What does the employees look like? What does this generation actually want? And so we're designing a system around this idea of being able to come in and out of federal government. We want them to come into us. Give us 3 to 5 years, right? And then we want you to go out into private sector and become whatever it is that you're going to become. And then we want to keep in touch with you and we want to bring you back. And to your point, maybe we're bringing you back whenever you're already independently wealthy, right? And you just want to give back to your country. We're cool with that. That's exactly what we're really actually looking for is this idea. But you have to create a system in which people can actually freely flow in and out of the federal government. That will be a cornerstone of the new system that we're building.
And what about the hiring process itself? Is that something that you're also looking at as part of this new system? Because the length of time still continues to be, it seems like it's intractable. after 10 years, I've been watching attempts to shorten the federal hiring cycle, and it just seems impervious to improvement. Is that part of what you're looking at?
Oh, absolutely. So we absolutely want to streamline the hiring process. And then one of the things we're going to do is strategically recruit from a variety of sources. So today, for the most part, we have to put everything up on USA Jobs. We get thousands of people who apply for our jobs. That's not an issue. Calling through that list, though, to find, the select few that are actually extremely highly qualified or the cyber ninjas that we're looking for, that's where the length of time actually comes in. So our ability to strategically recruit, like go to a Black Hat event, right, or go to RSA conferences, things like that, where we know that this talent is at, and be able to then recruit them and basically offer them tentative job offers on the spot, that's what we're actually going after. So we are in the process of writing those rules in such a way that we will actually be able to do that.
And yes, I recall last year you had a couple of big hiring fair type situations where you brought even security screeners to make sure people had initial ability to apply for a federal job and so on. And some people were hired on the spot. A lot of publicity about those events in the now year on since they've happened. Sounds like the long-term success was also there.
Sure. I mean, any time that you can shorten a hiring process by 6 to 8 weeks, you're going to make everybody happy, right?
But you got people in from those last year events.
Absolutely.
And it's something you want to keep going with.
Yes, we got over 450 folks in for cyber specifically and for IT in general. And so, we're actually just met with the CIO Council just a few weeks ago to have a conversation about, so what does the next event look like? How do we, make sure that we are as successful as we were in the past? And how do we build upon that? One of the other things, switching gears a little bit away from cyber, in June coming up here, we're going to actually have a women in law enforcement event, and we're going to Arlington, Texas to have that event. And so, again, pulling all the components together who have law enforcement this time joining. There is nothing greater than the power of DHS coming together, right? Have all the components, bring in all of our cool toys so that we can display the mission. People love to touch and feel a mission. It's easy to, a job announcement that's 10 pages long is not exciting or sexy, but bring in the president's limo, bring in a puppy, right, from CBP, bring in a firing range, bring in a response vehicle from FEMA, show what human trafficking, the effects of human trafficking and how you could make a difference, like with what ICE does. Those are powerful things. We actually are even setting up a physical fitness gym, if you will, so that when people come in, if they want to apply for our law enforcement jobs, here, take this and go through the entire physical fitness thing and see whether or not this is really
for you.
Can you
do those dozen pull-ups?
Exactly, exactly. And so I think by just, so that's using the current system, right? And just being incredibly creative and really forward thinking on how do we actually make the kinds of hires that we want to, given the current rules. So we've got that going on. At the same time, we're building for the future. And so the two, I think, inform each other. But it's exciting to be at DHS right now, especially in human capital, because I think we are kind of leading the way with so many of these innovative ideas. And I'm quite proud of the team.
So it sounds like the authority that you got for the cyber workforce to rebuild that system, I think it was Title VI that you said?
Correct.
It sounds like, though, the learnings from rebuilding that could be replicated for other domains outside of cyber as you go forward.
Exactly. Exactly. And so you always want to be able to build something that's not only just for one occupation, right? But then how do you turn around and use those same concepts and principles and apply those to a different group of folks. So, I mean, so one of the things that we're doing is you got to start, I think, thinking about these things by occupation. So law enforcement has its own culture. So you have cultures of CBP and ICE, for example, or FEMA, TSA, and Secret Service. But within those then are subcultures, and then there's subcultures underneath those. And so the thing to do, I think, is be really understand those cultures, understand what drives the folks within those cultures, and then design systems around that versus trying to do everything from a DHS perspective or from a Washington, D.C. perspective when it's just not going to be applicable to those folks that are actually down on a line.
We're speaking with Angela Bailey. She's Chief Human Capital Officer at the Homeland Security Department. Now, the Trump administration famously has come out with three executive orders dealing with labor relations and dealing with employees as individuals. And some of it is really old policy, just emphasizing this part of the policy instead of that part. For example, the 30-day improvement periods versus how long they sometimes go. Some of it does seem to cross into new policy. What's your reaction to it? How will you get it done?
What we're really doing from a DHS perspective is absolutely taking a look at those executive orders. We're working very closely with OPM to make sure that we understand the guidance that would be coming, the follow-on guidance that would be coming out from OPM, because we absolutely want to make sure that we are following what I'll call the spirit and the intent of those executive orders as we're implementing those. We're balancing that, of course, with long-established relationships that we've had with unions. We've got long-standing past practices that are in place. We have negotiated agreements that are actually being negotiated right now. And so we're looking at those to say, how do we take the executive orders and how do we blend those into those current negotiations that are going on? What do we do with the fact that we have, again, long-standing past practices, but perhaps negotiation or contracts aren't up for renegotiation right now? So we're just really taking a look at everything and making sure that we look at this from a consistency standpoint, but that we also, again, I'll foot stomp this, but again, we have to look at the current relationships and what's also going on within these different components.
And that 30-day employee improvement period in particular kind of struck me as something very concrete. And there are a lot of jobs where if you can't do it within 30 days, then the person should go. But there are some jobs, again, those DC-type jobs where it might be, how is this program going? And you might not even have results from an improvement plan for 6 months. And so it seems like you still need flexibility in how long you deal with an individual with respect to their improvement plan.
Right. And so from an employee relations standpoint, I mean, you're absolutely right. And so I think that there is goodness in all of these executive orders. I'll call it challenge for lack of better words, is that how you implement those will actually, I think, what's the words, proof in the pudding kind of thing. But I think that that's what we really need to really think about. And so, because you make an excellent point about depending on which job it is, what the mission is, what they're trying to accomplish, that's how we'll have to really make a determination about how long it takes for them to improve. I mean, today we have probationary periods, right, of 1 year. Very rarely are they used. It doesn't make any sense to me why those are very rarely used.
I mean, if someone's not going to work out, sometimes you know in 2 days,
right,
is a matter of practical reality.
Yeah, exactly. But what we have to do is, I think, tighten up these probationary periods. One of the other things, DHS, that we really would like to see is 2-year probationary periods in particular for many of our positions that require academies and, you know, training and extensive training and stuff. Heck, by the time they get done with their training, their probationary period's already up, right? So, I mean, those are just all the things that we're thinking about. But I will say, while we will absolutely strive for consistency and make sure that we are in line with the federal government and where the administration wants to go, we'll also, again, balance that with what we know is going on at a very local level.
So to summarize, lots of changes, lots of challenges. It's a time of great ferment, let's say, in federal HR. Good time to be in federal HR?
Yeah. I mean, one could say it's always a good time to be in federal HR, right? So there's always something new and innovative that we can do. And in this particular case, the administration is helping us along, I think, in some areas. So it's a good kick in the pants for some of the things that perhaps folks have been talking about for a long time. And so I do think it's a good time. But for me, I mean, it's always really just kind of a good time because I'm always just thinking of these things as a puzzle. Or a challenge, and it's like, how do we solve the latest puzzle?
Angela Bailey is Chief Human Capital Officer at the Homeland Security Department. We'll post this interview at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe at iTunes or Podcast One.